killers, murderers, decoding the crime verse.
911, what's your emergency? Hello, 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 and welcome back to Decoding the Crime Verse. I'm Danny, and I'm joined with...
Lori!
Yes, that is correct. And we have a rather interesting case, and I am actually convinced that the person that was arrested is not guilty of this case.
Okay.
I firmly believe that, but that's my own opinion. We'll see what your opinion is after we look at the facts.
Let's get into this.
We are dealing with the lipstick killer because, I think, Glory, can you assume why was he called that? What is your guess?
Well, prior to us recording this podcast, I had taken a guess and it was like, let me guess, he killed people and wrote on the wall with lipstick.
That is correct. So, listen, I'd rather it be lipstick than blood.
Fair enough.
You get me?
But it doesn't change the fact that he killed him.
Yeah, I know. But imagine like just taking blood and being like on the wall, like horror movie style. I mean, that's like really messed up.
I mean, that's up there in terms of crime.
It really is. So we're going to look at, there were three murders for the lipstick killer. And that obviously three makes a serial killer. If you do two, you're not a serial killer yet. It's when you get to three that you are officially classified as a serial killer. So there are three cases. And the first one was on the afternoon of June 5th, 1945. And was a 43-year-old named Josephine Ross. And she was found dead in her home on the north side of the city. And this was all in Chicago. She was stabbed 4 times in the throat.
What?
I actually cannot... Ugh. Like, that must be excruciatingly painful. Not that it's any less bad, but at least if you're being stabbed in your stomach, it's like...
I don't think that's any better, though.
No, but think about it, right? If you stabbed your stomach, you're being stabbed, like, in your, like, fat and muscle... Your throat, he's literally having to have enough pressure to break through your, like, bones. Like, isn't that...
This
like,
is freaky.
That's crazy. Okay. Her wounds had been covered with adhesive tape, and her head had been bound in a skirt. There was blood splattered all over the apartment, and it had been ransacked, but the police found no fingerprints and no motive. Right? The second killing was when the body of a 32-year-old named Francis Brown was discovered 6 months later on the morning of December 11th in the bathroom of her apartment at the Pine Grove Hotel. She had been shot in the head and then stabbed with a bread knife that had been driven into her neck with such a force that the blade emerged on the other side of her throat.
That's so crazy.
That is like a mental, okay? Her body had been stripped naked and rinsed of blood. Her head had been wrapped in towels. The police found themselves even more hampered by the lack of evidence, and the apartment had apparently been wiped clean of fingerprints. But this time, someone had left a message for them. On the living room wall, written in odd curling hand using Brown's red lipstick, were the words, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." My guy, turn yourself in. Okay.
Yeah, but he just said he cannot control himself.
Yeah, so turn yourself in.
Obviously, he's not. His urge like, is bigger than his desire to.
To me, that is completely, like, psychotic. Like, it is completely psychotic. Like... What I cannot imagine what is going through you, through your brain, that you have the urge to kill someone. I mean, at all. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, I know there's the acts where things happen, like, in a fit of rage, and you weren't exactly planning to kill the person, and next thing you hit them, and they hit their head, and whatever. But, I mean, this is meticulously, like... you've actually sat and thought about killing. That's just so mental to me. I will never understand it. Never. Well, I suppose I'm not a murderer, so I wouldn't understand. The third one was the most savage. Okay, and it actually sent the town into terror. At about 7:30 on the morning of January 7th, 1946, James Denigan discovered that his six-year-old daughter, Suzanne, was missing from her bedroom in their apartment in a wealthy neighborhood on the north side. He called the police at about 10 a.m. Five men were on the scene, reporters, press, photographers, detectives, patrolmen. It was huge. This is if it's one thing I know, especially in America, if someone goes missing, I think you have to wait 48 hours before you can, like, declare it. But with kids, it's an immediate thing. Yeah. So if a kid is gone, you can immediately go to the police. But for example, if I went missing, you'd have to wait 2 days, which to me is so stupid.
It is.
Because I could be dead, and you waited 2 days to come find me. That's, like, so ridiculous. You can't just assume that, oh, they disappeared for 2 days to, like, get their life together. No, if someone disappeared, please do your jobs and find them. Like, what is this? Like, it's so stupid. I'm completely against that. Anyway, searching Suzanne's room, cops found a crumpled note telling the family that to prepare a $20,000 ransom, okay, to not notify the police and wait for word from the kidnapper. It wasn't long, however, before it was revealed to be a cruel ruse. At 7 p.m. that night, Suzanne's head was found less than a block away, floating sewer.
Whoa.
Okay, her little blue ribbons were even still tied to her hair.
So man's just literally butchered her whole neck out.
And during the next few hours, her legs and torso were recovered from separate locations. Now, first of all, this is where I find things already suspicious. How were these three cases linked? And the reason I say that is when you have a serial killer, you can often pick out a specific motive or a specific way they do things, like they have a trademark or they have a specific type of people they are killing. Number one, all three were of different ages. We had an older woman, a more middle-aged woman, and then a kid, right? Mm. All were killed differently, right? We had stabbings to the throat, a shooting with a stabbing, and then decapitation. Okay, clearly this guy's maybe had something with necks, but anyway. For me, the cases are very different. And that is not normally what you find with serial killers. Because then how do you actually connect that this is the same person?
Yeah.
If they had found lipstick writing at all three crime scenes, I would have been 100% yes, this could be the same person. But they didn't. They literally found lipstick at one of them. So were the police maybe frantic and not knowing, like, they had these murders happen really close together, these horrific murders happen really close together, that they needed an explanation, and the most possible explanation that there was one serial killer instead of three serial killers?
Yeah.
Okay? Do you understand me? It's weird. It's weird. So they did arrest someone, and he sat in prison from the age of 17 till the age he died in 2012. Okay, I mean, that is hella long, right?
For real.
I mean, that is very, very long time. So we're going to look at him. And after I read through the case, I read through information, and I read through a journalist had an interview with him. I don't believe he did it. I don't. And I think what happened to him is disgusting. And I think it is a complete atrocious act by the Chicago police. But let's get into it. So, as gruesome details of the murder went out on, like, the television and the radio, the case became the first national crime sensation of the post-war era, so after the war. The Chicago police questioned thousands of men and women and arrested many suspects. Months went by and the police exhausted what leads they had, and by the start of the summer in 1946, the few smudged fingerprints that were found by the FBI on the ransom notes were literally all they had to go on. Right. So, We are dealing with Mr. Bill. I don't know how to say this, but I think it's Herrains. Don't quote me on that, but we'll call him Bill for the sake of me. Despite his dimming memory and the ocean of time has passed, he literally can still remember what happened on June 25th, 1946, and he was 17 at that time. So, in many ways, Bill had a happy childhood in Chicago. He was a very bright boy and had an interest in fixing things, who was found fond of drawing and telling his younger brother science fiction stories about rockets and space travel. So, he had a pretty ordinary childhood. We didn't have abuse and funny, shady things happening there. But by 17, he actually had become a petty criminal. He had been found guilty in juvenile court of 10 counts of burglary, and he was sentenced to spend a year in a semi-correctional school in Indiana. When he was back in Chicago the following summer, he was arrested again, and this time sent away to a private school, also in Illinois. But in both places, he proved to be a good student, and he actually won a place at the University of Chicago as part of an experimental scheme to open to gifted students. And yeah. He enrolled for a Bachelor of Science as he wanted to actually become an engineer. So we can see, yes, maybe he had a few mishaps. He was a bit of a naughty kid, stealing, got himself in trouble. But, I mean, he was overall, it sounded, I mean, he's not the worst of the worst.
Not at all.
Slaughtering animals in his back garden and eating them. Anyway, you get what I'm saying. So, by Christmas 1945, which was 2 weeks before Susan's disappearance, Bill had returned to his old habits of breaking into strangers' homes. I suppose it is kind of like an addiction.
Yeah.
Okay, that, I mean, he's the, yeah, but anyway. So, on the afternoon of June 26, 1946, Bill set out for the post office to cash in the $1,000 in saving bonds bought with the money taken from his burglary. So he got these bonds and now he needed the cash because he was going on a date with his girlfriend. And because he planned to carry so much money, he actually had a revolver in his pocket just in case, you know, shady streets, shady people come and try and rob him. When he found the post office was closed, he decided to get cash that he needed for the date by robbing a building. I mean, just tell her you're going to go walk in the park, my guy.
Yeah.
Like, what is this? Anyway, right. This was a few blocks actually away from Susan's house. So he was in the vicinity. He had just lifted a dollar bill from inside an open apartment when a tenant spotted him. He then ran up the back stairs of the nearby building and was cornered by two policemen, and he actually pulled out his gun. They had a struggle, and the officer, whose name was Abner Cunningham, was actually still in his swimming trunks when he arrived at the scene because he was an off-duty officer. Okay. Right. Picking up a stack of three flower pots, Cunningham then smashed it repeatedly over Bill's head, and he was left unconscious. Now, I don't know about you. I understand if the guy's resisting arrest, but it doesn't sound okay to smash a flower pot over his head.
Yeah, not at all.
Repeatedly. Like, isn't that a little bit police brutality?
I was about to say, it sounds a little bit crazy. I mean, if anything, like, you can forcefully get him down and try to handcuff him.
Yes. I mean, like, get him to the floor, handcuff him. And yes, I understand maybe you might need to whack him so he falls, but to repeatedly smash flower pots on him, to me, that's like a little bit crazy. Just a tad crazy. So his head was stitched up and bandaged, and he was taken to the police hospital at the Cook County Jail, where he was strapped to a bed.
Yeah.
Okay. He feigned unconsciousness, but heard someone say that he was the prime suspect in the Suzanne case. And he felt, as he was like going in and out of consciousness, his fingerprints being taken. So obviously they thought, okay, he was in the area. He was breaking in somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe he took the girl. Right. Meanwhile, the police raided his parents' house, his room at the university, and a locker at an L station, and discovered a lot of his, like the stuff he had stolen from other burglaries. On the third day that he'd now been held or had been arrested, he heard that his prints had been matched to the ransom note. Okay, so already this is like suspicious, okay? And the state's attorney announced that the police had arrested Suzanne's murderer. Still tied to the bed, Bill was encouraged to talk.
Wow.
And I'm going to... You can't obviously see me because this is obviously a podcast, but I am doing air quotes on the word encouraged. Okay. First, by a male nurse who was pouring ether on his private parts.
Oh, what's that?
I think it's like might be like a type of alcohol, but I could be wrong. I know ether is enlightening.
I just hope it's not like some kind of
ether,
like acid.
Any class of organic compounds characterized by an oxygen atom. Ethers are similar in structure to alcohols. So I'd assume it would have a not nice effect down there. Just saying.
Yeah.
Then, later by a detective who has punched him repeatedly in the stomach. Okay. Again, what type of questioning is this?
Yeah, something.
Like, that is torture. Like... No. Like, for me already, it's like, what is going on?
Yeah.
The cops insisted that he was responsible for not only killing Susan, but also for Frances Brown and Josephine Ross and two other women whose murders had never been solved. So I think they were under pressure by the society, the media, the government. We need answers to this killing. Well, guess what? We have this guy in custody. We'll just put it
literally,
all
just
on
pin it all
him,
on him.
Okay? And then you beat the living daylights out of the man while he's in hospital because you've cracked a flipping flower pot, that's a new one. A flower pot on his head. Anyway, Bill was grilled relentlessly under a blazing spotlight. The details of Suzanne's murder were repeated to him, okay? Not him telling them the details. They were like, you did this. This is how you did it. This happened. It's like, you know, when you're trying to like convince someone they did something like through like force and manipulation. That's what this sounds like to me.
Almost like they're patronizing him.
Yes. Yeah. And they tried to prompt him to explain how he had done it and why he had done it. Still, he refused to confess. On the fourth day, two psychiatrists arrived and injected him with sodium pentanol, which is known by a lot of people as the truth serum drug. It's supposed to make your brain more susceptible to telling the truth. Now, again, that also doesn't seem right to me.
Mm.
Okay? Like, that is... Yeah. I mean, no. Okay? On the fifth day, he was given a spinal tap to determine if he was malingering. I have no idea what that means. But he was given no anesthetic. And I know spinal taps are sore. I mean, I would assume they are sore. I don't know what they are, but I've heard they are sore. Anyway. But do you see, like, this has been 3-4 days of absolute torture for this guy. And he hasn't even confessed or said that he did it.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. He was then convicted, found guilty, and put in prison. In prison, more than 30 years later, he was typing up the manuscript of an autobiography that he never finished. And he said, For the first time, I thought of taking the blame for the murder. Oh, sorry, let me read that again. So in prison for more than 30 years, he actually typed up a manuscript for an autobiography, which he never finished. And he said, when they had given him that sodium pentanol, which is the truth serum, he said, and I quote, "That was for the first time I thought of taking the blame for the murders I was accused of." So he was going through so much pain and torment that he was rather willing to accept it so that it would go away.
So that truth serum doesn't necessarily only help you to tell the truth. It actually pushes
it
words
probably
out of
does.
You.
Yeah, it makes your brain like susceptible. After being tortured and held without food, sleep, or access to an attorney, for 5 days. That is so against the Constitution in America. Everyone in their, I mean, I'm watching Suits at the moment. I know, like, you are not, if a person says, like, they need their lawyer, you cannot force anything out of them without an attorney. Like, they do not have to speak to you at all.
Yeah.
The fact he was not even offered one. And there's a thing also in America, you've got people, you can hire your own attorney and pay, but if you cannot, the state provides one for you.
Yeah.
So he should have been offered an attorney, okay? Bill was finally indicted for assault with the intent to kill, robbery, 23 counts of burglary, and 3 counts of murder on July 12, 1946. And he was transferred to the county jail, where lawyers hired by his parents explained that for the burglaries alone, he faced imprisonment. So yes, he might not have killed the people, but he still would have ended up in prison for the robberies.
Yeah.
Which I get it, and that he should go to prison for, because yes, he was responsible and he is guilty of that, but he should not then have been charged with stuff that was not on him. Because another thing, if he didn't kill those people, it means the people who did kill those people are still on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the state attorney's office actually offered him a deal. They said in exchange for his confession to all 3 murders, he would be spared the death sentence.
Yeah.
Okay. And would receive 3 concurrent life sentences and would have a chance of parole in 20 years. However, 2 weeks later, after being kept in solitary confinement and being repeatedly rehearsed in the details of the crimes, so literally, his attorneys had to come and tell him, you have to say this, this is how it happened. So that, I mean, if he's confessed, the facts had to be right. The fact that his attorneys had to train him on how to confess already shows me this guy did not do what they were saying that he was doing. Okay. Bill was ready to confess, but when the day came when he faced the courtroom, he denied knowing anything about the murders. Obviously, the attorney was humiliated and said that the deal was off. And now his confession would get him 3 consecutive sentences, life terms to be served end to end. And so on August 7th, 1946, after spending 42 days in custody and making 3 attempted suicides, Bill confessed to the state attorney Bill confessed to the state attorneys that he had stabbed and shot and killed Francine Brown and Josephine Ross and gone to strangle and dismember Suzanne. So he confessed to them. Now, he began his sentence at Stateville, which is a maximum security prison that housed Chicago's most dangerous criminals. And mail began to come in immediately. And this is a shame. I thought this was quite harsh. His girlfriend mails him and says, I think of you often, very often. I don't worry because I know you can take care of yourself. And then he never heard from her again, which is pretty sad. Anyway, Bill has insisted upon his innocence almost from the moment his sentence began, when he realized that if he recanted, the grilling, the beating, and the torture wasn't going to start all over again. When he first arrived at Stateville in 1946, the psychiatrists were still regularly questioning him. Bill asked an orderly what they would do to him if he told them he hadn't murdered anyone. And listen to this. This is ridiculous. And they said, well, kid, I don't give a damn one way or another. And now you're in prison for it. No one else will care one way or another either. So now even that, if he didn't do it and he said, no, I didn't do it, no one would care. And he was going to have to stay.
Why? Because he took this.
Because no one cared. They're like, we have our guy. He's in prison. The media's off our backs. Everyone's off our backs.
Yeah.
So after many years, it's simply too late to prove whether his convictions were well-founded. Mm. 6 decades after his confession, almost all the evidence that helped put him in jail has been discredited.
Oh, wow.
Okay? The fingerprints connecting him to the crime scene may have been planted. And independent experts have shown that the handwriting matches neither the ransom note or the lipstick on the wall of the apartment. Indeed, a veteran newspaper man in Chicago say that the message of the lipstick killer wasn't written by the murderer at all, but by a reporter who arrived at the scene before the police and decided to add an extra twist to the story. So the lipstick might not have even been a thing.
Yeah.
In the meantime, the decay of physical evidence has placed the case far beyond the reach of DNA analysis, and the surviving fingerprint evidence is locked in the vaults of the Chicago Police Department, and the state cannot be compelled to surrender it for retesting. In many ways, he says he knows that that his life has been wasted, and there are a lot of things he would have liked to have done if he hadn't been arrested in 1946. He could have gotten in on the ground floor of a solid-state electronics or become an inventor. And he even said he had a few ideas that he thinks would have been, he made him very rich, or he would have started a business. And unfortunately, he died in 2012. And yeah. So yes, 100%, he should have gone to prison for the burglaries. No dispute there. None whatsoever. He broke in, he stole, he must go. But to have 3 life sentences put on you for murder, when you can see that there was literally torture and manipulation of the evidence, that is ridiculous.
For real.
Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So, I will die on this hill. This man did not kill these 3 people.
Die on the hill is a little bit crazy, but okay.
Ah, it means my opinion will never be budged. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
I firmly believe this guy is innocent of these 3 killings.
Mm.
And so, and like I said, I don't even know if it was a serial killer. I actually think there could have been 3 different people killing 3 different people. There, besides the fact that they all had something to do with the neck, it's very sketchy if it was actually one.
You never really know until you know.
No, I know that. And we never will actually know, because, I mean, the guy's dead. It's not like they're going to reopen the case. I mean, all the police officers are probably dead. The 3 real killers, or the real killer, are probably dead as well. So...
yeah,
it's not like we're going to get it. But anyway, that is the story of the lipstick killer. Yes. Any last thoughts that you would like to add?
Hopefully one day this gets uncovered and they tell us the
story. No, we always say that, but we never know. Although President Trump has just said he is signed a order thingy to declassify documents on JFK. Yeah. So I'm hoping there's some really interesting things that come out of that, because we then will definitely discuss it on this show.
Yeah, you for can. Sure.
Oh, guys, JFK is one of my favorite cases
Dead
out
on
there.
It, count on it.
Oh, but that is all for this week. We hope you enjoyed. We will see you same time. We will see you same time, same place next week. Bye bye.
Bye.
Active FM radio has never been better.